Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the ceasefire that went into effect today in Syria that was brokered by the US and Russia and assess the chances of it lasting for the week as planned, given the patchwork of over 1,000 militias on both sides of a civil war that has killed about 500,000 Syrians, destroyed much of the country and displaced over a third of the population. David Lesh, the Distinguished Professor of Middle East History at Trinity University and author of The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria, joins us to discuss why the Obama administration reluctantly decided to join the Russian initiative and whether giving up the demand that the Assads leave power is any great loss, since power on the Syrian government side has devolved to various warlords and factions that are unlikely to want a return of the status quo ante, even if that were possible. Then, with Hillary Clinton recovering from walking pneumonia and a very bad weekend, we will look into the role of the press, which is more focused on nitpicking and re-examining the appearance of scandal associated with Clinton's emails than holding Trump to account for his daily gaffes, lies, displays of frightening ignorance, and outbursts of hatred, demagoguery, and racism. Thomas Edsel, a professor of journalism at Columbia University, whose column on demographic and strategic trends in American politics appears every Wednesday in the New York Times, joins us to discuss how, with Trump, even with Clinton in some polls, if the reality star ends up becoming the next president of the United States, it will be in large part because the press gave him a free ride. First, as Trump came to prominence with free media, then as the Republican presidential nominee, where he was afforded a false equivalence as an equal on the world stage with his opponent, all the while failing to check him or challenge him as they instead pile on constant criticism of Hillary Clinton. Then finally, Gloria Steinem joins us in the studio to discuss the presidential race, the sexist assaults on Hillary Clinton from the likes of Rudy Giuliani, peddling conspiracy theories that question her stamina and fitness for the presidency, as well as talking about Gloria Steinem's life on the road, the political battle she's engaged in over the decades, and the deep influence that Native American culture and political life has had on her, which, with the current ongoing confrontation in North Dakota between the Standing Rock Sioux and other tribes and a Wall Street-backed oil pipeline, has particular resonance as old wounds are opened and an American president, for a change, does the right thing. All this along with insights from Gloria Steinem's latest book, just out in paperback, My Life on the Road. And joining us now is David Lesh, who is a Ewing Hassell Distinguished Professor of Middle East History at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, and the author of 14 books, including Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad, The Arab-Israeli Conflict, A History, and The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Lesh.
Good to be back, Ian.
And this nationwide ceasefire brokered by the United States and Russia that went into effect today in Syria, apparently it's going to go on for 7 days unless there's some kind of outbreak that the Syrian regime feels it has to respond to. But there's, of course, from the rebel side, there's a lot of reservations, to say the very least, and it seems as if the United States was very reluctant to even make the deal with Russia, with, I believe, internal conflict between Secretary of State Kerry and the Secretary of Defense. So what chances do you give it?
Well, I don't want to sound too cynical because, it's a first step, and nothing's happening without some sort of U.S. and Russian cooperation, particularly in terms of getting their allies in and outside of Syria on the same page with regard to an eventual end to the conflict. However, I am a bit cynical about the success for this, just simply based on the track record. You know, we had a cessation of hostilities in February that unraveled. This seems to be a little bit more detailed, but again, hard to maintain without some mechanism to ensure compliance. And furthermore, you know, people, I think, on the outside just don't understand how fragmented the war is on all sides of the conflict. We know about the fragmentation of the opposition throughout much of the country, but in fact, the Syrian government forces are fragmented as well. Bashar al-Assad's power has been diluted over the years, and in fact, many of the pro-government militias are under government authority in name only. They've been fighting on their own for a number of years. And so the bottom line is, can there be like one order given to any significant, you know, side in the conflict, the government side, the opposition, that says cease and desist, and everyone cease and desist? And so that, I don't think that's going to happen. And so I believe there's going to be a lot of leeway given to so-called breaches of the cessation of hostilities, episodic, sporadic fighting, I think will continue. You know, how much is too much and will break down the whole process is left up to anyone's interpretation. And then there's the problem, of course, is separating what used to be Jabhat al-Nusra from the so-called moderate opposition groups, non-jihadist opposition groups, because they are so intermingled and intermixed, particularly in the north part of the country, in and outside of Aleppo and around Idlib. And so separating those, which is one of the elements of this U.S.-Russian agreement, is going to be very, very difficult. And if they aren't separated, then, in fact, it seems to be that the U.S. and Russia are going to just go after them anyhow, which will obviously target jihadist groups, but also non-jihadist groups, which will, in the end, help the regime of Bashar al-Assad. So many, many obstacles. And even if you get all of those, you know, if all of those are achieved, then you have to get some sort of a political settlement and enter negotiations to begin with. And we're back right where we started in terms of all of those obstacles that have prevented any sort of political settlement to date. Mainly, you know, what is the transition going to look like from what it is today to what it will be in the future? And, of course, that revolves around the position of Bashar al-Assad. And should he stay or should he go, or how long should he stay, and all of these questions. So, you know, again, it's a step. It's a step that has to be taken, but a long, long way to go before it can be considered successful.
And again, I'm speaking with David Lesh, who is a distinguished professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, and the author of 14 books, including Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad, The Arab-Israeli Conflict of History, and The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. But Assad has been doing well on the battlefield, albeit using the most deplorable tactics of starvation, which have been very effective, and the rebel enclave that has basically been able to even shell the Russian embassy has basically surrendered. I'm amazed that any rebel fighter would surrender to Bashar al-Assad's forces. And what do you think their fate is?
Well, you know, the regime of Bashar al-Assad, the government forces, they resort to such deplorable tactics because they really have no other choice. They have, from their perspective, very low in manpower and resources, as Bashar al-Assad himself admitted about a year ago before the Russian intervention. And, you know, they just do not have the resources to fight, you know, door to door and clear out urban neighborhoods where the, you know, it's very difficult for any technological advantage to make itself felt in terms of tanks and so forth. And so they just bomb everybody. And it's been obviously quite ugly. And it's this ugliness which unfortunately has compelled various opposition forces to surrender their or to withdraw from various areas. And so, you know, this type of tactic, unfortunate as it is, has worked for the regime thus far, starving, you know, using starvation as a weapon, and of course the constant bombing to bludgeon the opposition and the population that's supporting them into submission. And unfortunately, it's a war that where many sides are so dependent on outside forces for financial support, for military support, political support, that in many ways they've become divorced from the population itself. And so they're not as dependent upon them. And since they're not as dependent upon them, they take less care, I think, in trying to protect the populations. And this is from the opposition side as well as from the government side. And, of course, through all of this, it's the people in Syria that suffer the most.
Well, clearly this has become a proxy war, and that makes it all the more shameful. In fact, recently, Stefan de Mistura, the UN chief in Syria, made a very impassioned speech about how disgusting the situation is and how there is no peace. There's just more and more destruction, more and more death, and that no food is getting through, no convoys are getting through. And unusual for a diplomat to express that painful outrage that he did express. Now, Kerry says he has sleepless nights thinking about it. Putin is pretty cold-blooded and seems to have sort of waited him out. Is that what's happened here, that basically you have to accept the Russian deal because at some point or other, as distasteful it may be, the idea of more and more people being killed, you simply cannot let that go on indefinitely. Is that what sort of brought this peace deal about?
Yeah, I think, as we've discussed on prior shows, I mean, the Obama administration has been committed to not involving itself more assertively in Syria and getting, from their perspective, drawn into a military quagmire. And Russia is by far, you know, the most important influencer, the most important stakeholder from the outside in Syria, based on their military and financial support of the regime, and certainly their military intervention from about a year ago until the present day. And so they are running the show. And I think from the administration point of view, frankly speaking, if Russia can resolve this, more power to them. They figure it's more in Russia's interest to do so. Russia certainly doesn't want to get ensconced in a military quagmire. And I think they really do want a political settlement, although one on their terms, particularly with Bashar al-Assad and the institutions of the regime remaining in power. So they're not willing to compromise too much on that. But from the U.S. perspective, we can't really do much to affect the situation because Russia has invested so much in it, and we've recognized that. And so it seems to be that we will sink or swim with the Russians. And from our perspective, if the Russians sink, then, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing from some people's perspectives in Washington. That if they swim and this is resolved, then that's fine, because I think the Obama administration has wanted to find an off ramp from this conflict whenever they could.
So, but you said earlier, David Lesh, that you thought that there's been fracturing on the Assad side, that many of his forces have become autonomous units loyal to, I take it, warlords. I believe there's like 1,400 different factions fighting in this war. So is that to say then that even if you have to swallow a bitter pill, at least as far as the U.S. side is concerned, and accept that Assad will be around for a little longer, that at the end of the day his days are numbered because of internal dissent on his own side?
Well, I think there's going to have to be change. I mean, I've spoken with high-level Syrian officials over the past few years on a number of occasions, and they've been very upfront that they can't go back to the way it was. I mean, their patronage networks, clientelist networks that existed prior to the war have been shattered with this war. They've had to, you know, much more power has evolved away from the center and toward the periphery. And therefore, you know, I think they realize that they're not going to be able to return to the situation as existed before the war. Now, what that means, will they be able to give up enough power that'll satisfy a critical mass of the opposition who have become much more empowered with life without the state, you know, for all of these years? That's the big question. But as a formula, that if we ever can get to any sort of negotiations or any sort of peace talks, that's a formula that can be found, I think, you know, under the right circumstances and with the regional international stakeholders, most of them at least on the same page. But it's clear to me that you know, despite what Bashar al-Assad is saying, that he's going to reassert central control over the entire country again. His goal is to try to control this vertical line of cities from Aleppo to Hama, Homs, and Damascus, and the coast, which, you know, has about 2/3 of the population, even though it's only about, you know, 30% of the territory, and then just hold on. And in this new environment, which they hope to shape in their direction, rather than in terms of too much decentralization of power away from the center, maybe over time, that is a decade or two, be able to reassert over control over the rest of the country. But in reality, I don't think he can return to the way it was. Whether or not they really accept that and realize that, at the end of the day, is a big question.
Well, it does seem that it's because the Assad family see themselves as having this divine right to rule over their private plantation, as they have done for the last five decades. I mean, that at the end of the day, is there any collective bitterness, even on his own side, that it's his, inflexibility, and he's been so obdurate that he's brought this catastrophe on himself? Or are there enough people like, the various Christian and Shia minorities who would feel that they'd be slaughtered by the jihadis, so they sort of have to stick with him and hold their nose? I mean, I'm just trying to get a handle on how deep his support is, even though the Muhabarat that controlled the country prior to this civil war, of course, were ubiquitous.
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent point. I mean, there are a number of groups that, while they may not very much like Assad, he's better than the alternative. They're afraid of what might come should the regime fall, such as the Christians and Druze and Shiites and a number of Sunnis. I mean, they're quite frankly, there are probably more Sunnis in the country that are supportive to some degree of the government than are against it, which is again hard to believe from the outside, despite and because of all the media attention that has defined the opposition as a Sunni opposition. So hopefully that doesn't delude Assad into thinking that he can restore the status quo ante before the war. But he, he's going to owe lots of people, lots of warlords and tribal chiefs and heads of various quarters of city. Of the cities that remained loyal, and if there is an end to the war, they're gonna want something in return, and there's gonna be a lot of bargaining, hard bargaining, and negotiating between the regime should it survive in some respect, and these new power brokers, and that's but they're thinking first things first. They're thinking survive, and we'll deal with that later. And they very much take this kind of paternalistic attitude toward the rest of the country, that they are best in the position to serve the country and to save the country, which is what they, I really do think many of them believe they're doing. They're saving the country from, in their point of view, terrorists and jihadists, and trying to protect a secular way of life that had existed beforehand. But I don't think the regime really understands how much power has devolved away from the center, and how much they're going to have to give up in terms of power and control if they do remain in power, which would mean over the long term, perhaps, should this thing be settled anytime soon, that there will be a changing political situation in Syria, whether they like it or not.
Well, David Lesch, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Take care, Ian.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with David Lesch, who's the Ewing Housel Distinguished Professor of Middle East History at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, and the author of 14 books, including Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad, The Arab-Israeli Conflict, A History, and The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into if Trump is elected, then you can blame the press. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Thomas Edsel, a professor of journalism at Columbia University. His column in the New York Times on demographic and strategic trends in American politics appears every Wednesday, and he's the author of Power and Money, Writing About Politics, The New Politics of Inequality, and his latest book is The Age of Austerity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Edsel.
Good to be back with you.
And obviously Hillary Clinton's had a very bad weekend, starting out with her comments about half of Donald Trump's supporters being a basket of deplorables. Particularly extraordinary to think that she sort of emphasized that rather than the second half, which was really quite sensible and I think something that needs to be talked about. And she should be reaching out to to Trump supporters rather than patronizing them. But how could somebody with all that experience end up having the press, you know, come down on it like that? You know, obviously politicians should, or one assumes, try to learn how to handle the press and to take advantage of the press rather than feed them negatives.
She really does not have political skills. She's not, her husband never would have made that mistake. Maybe Al Gore would make that kind of mistake, but there are some politicians who intuitively know sort of the boundaries of where you can go in comments. For her to stereotype basically a quarter of the electorate, roughly that, she hopes it's not a quarter, but at any rate, it's obviously a mistake. She can talk about the problems raised by many of Trump's supporters in terms of racism, all kinds of questionable, deplorable, if you want, characteristics, but you can't give a percentage and then sort of basically demonize a whole group. And she does not have that intuitive ability.
Well, then, of course, on Sunday at the 9/11 memorial ceremony, she was seen sort of being shaky on her feet, getting into a van, and then the campaign said that she was suffering from heat, as opposed to pneumonia, which was later their subsequent release. So again, what explains that instinct to cover up, which always makes it seem like they're really trying to cover up something, which is what, of course, feeds the Republican machinery that has managed successfully to cast her as somebody that you can't trust and who lies.
It's really an unfortunate but fact of Hillary's life is that she has had this instinct not to disclose, to act more like a lawyer in a litigation fight than a politician in a public relations fight. And it has hurt her as far back as the Whitewater days, when a scandal that really wasn't a scandal in part exploded because she refused to give out all the documents back then. She has not very good instincts for someone who's running for president, and it has hurt her time after time. It may not fatally damage her, but she certainly isn't doing her campaign any good with this.
Well, at the moment, she doesn't have a campaign. She's
2 days. She's out or whatever it is.
Yes, well, that's at least what we know of now. But walking pneumonia is something not to be taken lightly. And it does feed into the Rudy Giuliani narrative, unfortunately. So how do you explain then why this candidate, who is so manifestly unstable, ignorant, reckless, etc., he could go on with adjectives all day talking about Donald Trump, and yet they're almost even, and now she's sort of on the ropes. What explains that? In any universe that I know, Hillary Clinton should be at least 20 points ahead.
Well, I think you got to split the blame or responsibility, I guess. I agree that in any normal world, someone running against Trump, virtually any senator or whatever, would be way ahead of him. One, I think, as the two examples this past weekend both show, she brings some of it on herself. There has also been an excessive negative coverage by the press of her activities compared to Trump's. Trump really has, in many respects, gotten away with murder, and has done what are arguably much more egregious things politically and as a businessman than she has done with her email or Benghazi or whatever. But the press has focused disproportionately on her and has not done Trump up. Trump's strange advantage results in part from the fact that he acknowledges that he does wrong, that he sort of diffuses the accusations by saying, sure, I give politicians contributions so they do me favors. And in fact, that serves to take the edge off, for example, his $35,000 to Pam Biondi, the Florida Attorney General, who then dropped an investigation of Trump University. But that was certainly more pay to play than virtually anything that they've come up with in connection with the Clinton Foundation, they being the press. So it really is a disproportionate balance that's taken place.
But so, I recall that, Thomas Edsel, that very issue was brought up on the plane when Trump was sitting with Pence and giving the reporters aboard the plane some FaceTime, as they call it. The reporters did not ask solid questions, follow-up questions. It was really appalling. Is it just that Trump is somehow, it's almost as though Trump is in a reality show that he's created all for himself, and the rest of us are in an old kind of reality, and he's in a new reality that he's creating where, you know, he'll end up a survivor in the White House, and he just doesn't follow any rules and says exactly what he wants to say, lies shamelessly, but again, he doesn't ever get pulled over. And if what happened with Matt Lauer is a premonition of what's going to happen in the debates, I'm not sure that Hillary Clinton will be able to pin him down. If she tries, she may waste all of her time trying to do so. So I guess this is a long-winded way to say I don't think our press is stepping up to the plate here and pulling this guy over. He's just shamelessly lying to them and manipulating them.
I actually think that the Matt Lauer case is going to work to Hillary's advantage, that none of the moderators are going to want to take the overwhelming criticism Lauer received after from left and right for his performance in those two sort of alleged interviews or whatever you want to call it. It was the top story everywhere that Lauer screwed up. And I don't think Chris, what's his name, from Fox or any of the moderators are going to feel much more on their toes, and they are going to be much more knowledgeable and prepared to at least challenge somewhat what Trump says. The history, though, is more complex. If you look at the early Trump campaign back in the primaries, he would say things, and it would get wide publicity, that everyone thought would kill his campaign. He would call, John McCain, say he was not a hero. He would say things that were off the charts. The press certainly did cover those things. But all they did was to apparently increase his level of support, his assault on political correctness, his personal assault, seemed to actually put him into a better and better position until he, in fact, finally won. And there, I can't remember how many times he said things that everyone said were going to drop him in his tracks, and that turned out not to at all. So it may be that the press has gotten wary of trying to go after him. I don't know. But I think there are many things in his business activities. Paul Waldman on the Washington Post did a very good job summarizing those. Basically, it was a paragraph to each, but it was sort of like a series of bullet paragraphs that were all the things that Trump should be challenged on. And they are long, and they are very substantial. And one of the very few people who's doing this is David Fahrenthold, another reporter at the Washington Post, who has pushed the Pam Biondi case when other members of the press really have been sitting on it. So I don't know what's going to happen, frankly. Maybe the press will get off its butt.
Well, Thomas Edsel, I thank you very much for your time.
Sure.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Edsel. He's a professor of journalism at Columbia University. His column in the New York Times on demographic and strategic trends in American politics appears every Wednesday. And he's the author of Power and Money, writing about politics, the new politics of inequality. And his latest book is The Age of Austerity. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we're back joined in the studio by Gloria Steinem. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now in the studio is Gloria Steinem, a writer, lecturer, and feminist activist who in 1972 co-founded Ms. Magazine and remained one of its editors for 15 years. In 1968, she helped found New York Magazine, where she was a political columnist and wrote feature articles. Her books include the bestsellers Revolution from Within, Outrageous Acts and Everyday Rebellions, and Moving Beyond Words, among others. The winner of numerous journalism and lifetime achievement awards, including receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Obama this year. She recently teamed up with Viceland on the 2016 Emmy-nominated show Woman. And her latest book, just out in paperback, is My Life on the Road. Welcome to Background Briefing.
Thank
Gloria
you so
Stein.
Much. Thank you.
And you are on the road. You're on the road as we speak, right?
Yes, I am.
You've been on the road. You're just telling me. Australia, New Zealand, Zambia, Italy.
I know. I thought life got simpler with age, but it turns out no, it's not. It's quite the contrary. I mean, I love what I do, but it does seem intense at the moment.
So is there some vestiges of your father's genes as a traveling soul?
Yes, it's odd, isn't it, that we think we've rebelled against our parents and then we discover we're living their lives after all. Of course, he was traveling in this country, and mostly that's what I do too.
Right.
And I'm really grateful to him because he taught me to live with insecurity, which is good for a freelance writer to know or an organizer to know.
But he wasn't good with money.
Yeah, no, he was hopeless. He was a wonderful, kind, funny, great man, but he was hopeless about money, right?
So, are you still celebrating? Your 80th birthday celebrations lasted at least a year, right?
Is it? Yes, but now I'm 82, so.
Oh, that, so you've, right, so right. you've run out of excuses. Have you? I guess you can't roll the clock back there, right? So. There's a whole bunch of things I wanted to talk about. Obviously, the book indicates a lot of the deep influence that Native American culture and political life has had on you, and of course, it's particularly current in this with the Standing Rock Sioux standoff with the big Wall Street-backed oil pipeline. For once, an American president's done the right thing, but the old wounds are clearly being opened. And mm-hmm. Dogs and being sicked on to women and children and pepper spray, et cetera. It's just a cruel reminder of the appalling history that we have with the First Nations people here in this country of theirs, which we call ours. Mm. But let's start with what we were just talking about in the segment before. what's happening here? Can you lift our spirits a little, because it's scary as hell. I mean, the press have enabled Donald Trump. They helped him with free media become where he is. He's in a reality show universe, and Hillary Clinton is reality, but we're not sure that reality shows, you know, in other words, Survivor in the White House is going to trump experience in the White House. Mm-hmm. And I'm not entirely sure whether how much we have become a Kardashian culture of Instagrams and vicarious living through, you know, Tory celebrities' lives. It couldn't be worse following this weekend with Hillary Clinton. She's going to be at least with the walking pneumonia. She'd need at least a week in bed, maybe 10 days. In 10 days' time, she has her first debate.
We have to let her be human, and we have to stop looking up and start looking at what we ourselves are doing, because it's all going to come down to who gets out to vote. I don't mean to be trite about this, but that's the truth. And it's especially important since this is the first election in a very long time without the Voting Rights Act. So, you know, we really need to attend to getting out to vote and perhaps fighting to vote. You know, we do have the majority on almost every issue, and also, you know, on the presidential candidates. But it does depend on who gets out there, and there are a lot of shenanigans going on. And I don't mean to be—I mean, here's my two parameters. Depression is remembering that Hitler was elected in a parliamentary system, but nonetheless on a low voter turnout. And my most cheerful self says that this has so demolished the Republican Party, which was taken over by old racist Democrats. I mean, you and I remember the party of Rockefeller and even the first Bush and, you know, a very different.
Right.
They were the first to support the Equal Rights Amendment. It was a centrist party. We remember that. But once the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964, then the old racist Democrats, like Jesse Helms and so on, moved over to the Republican Party and began to take it over. So because Trump has come up without the party, almost entirely by the media, because, as you point out, he gets ratings and they sell advertising, and that force is so strong that they keep putting him on, right?
Right.
But if he loses, it's possible that the real Republicans, the centrist Republicans, will take their party back. Because right now, if you look at the statement of purpose and issues and so on, there's almost nothing in there that the majority, even of Republicans, believe in.
But since we get our politics through the press one way or the other, either through, you know, the politicians. We've turned our politicians into telemarketers. They spend all their day raising money, and at the end of the day, that money is transferred to the mainstream media to buy commercials to keep them in power. So that's one half of it. And then you've got the free media that Trump has taken by storm. But then you've also got the media's convention of false equivalents that, the minute he got the nomination, the Republican nomination, he was therefore an equal player on the world stage with somebody that actually had some experience on the world stage.
Yes, it's the
and yet he
there are two sides to every issue problem. Right. I think the whole world is divided into two kinds of people: those who divide the world into two and those who don't. Right. because actually issues have six sides or seven right. sides; they don't just have two sides. So the very two side notion is doing us in all the time, and especially in this case, because it means that a total lie is getting the equal time with, a centrist truth.
So what can be done in terms of bursting that bubble? The press, even, I haven't noticed anybody particularly taking on. They've spent an awful lot of time, as Matt Lauer did, nitpicking Hillary Clinton's email story, beating that one to death, and at the same time getting streamlined by Trump with a blizzard of absurdity, but none of it ever gets challenged. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen it. I don't. I was asking Thomas Edsel whether there'll be a Edward R. Murrow moment. What do you think can break that spell? Or are the better angels simply no longer a majority in this country? Mm-hmm. I hate to think that.
No, I think the better angels are a majority, but, well, I think we have to use the social media and popular press. We have to take responsibility for this ourselves and not wait for an Edward R. Murrow moment and not wait for something to happen from above and just say, look, we are never going to have in the White House somebody who was a pioneer birther, who was so racist that was accusing President Kennedy of not being born in this country. We are never going to have in the White House somebody who is such a profound, not just sexist, misogynist. We're such a profound phony. I mean, he is, I would like to say as a New Yorker, that he is not a successful businessman. He is a successful con man. If he had just invested the money he inherited, this rich kid, he'd be richer than now. He's gone bankrupt so many times. We have to take these facts and tell them, as we are now in on our social media to our neighbors, and we have to do it. We have to get the vote out.
And that involves even the disaffected Bernie people. I mean, those that are being, you know, for some other reason or other, beguiled into thinking that this is again, you know, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, and therefore they'll vote for the the guy that doesn't know where Aleppo is.
No, I
or Jill Stein. I mean,
I have more faith in the Bernie people than that. I mean,
well, Bernie himself needs to come out a bit, though, don't you think?
Yes, he does. No, I mean, Bernie is a loner. So, right. But I think the Bernie people. I think I'm one of six lifetime Democratic Socialists because Michael Harrington was a friend, and I've campaigned for Bernie and all of that. So I have more faith that they are actually going to come out. But again, it's up to us to say, here's what's happening to Hillary. For instance, we need to explain that she is being swift voted, that whatever year it was that Kerry was a candidate.
2004. Yeah.
The tactic became not attacking the weakness of a candidate, but attacking the strength.
Exactly. So he was a war hero, and they took that away from him.
Right. And so it became a word in the language, swift voting. Right. And that is what is happening to Hillary, precisely because all the fact-checking services say clearly that she is the most accurate and the most honest. She is being attacked as lying, cheating, and so on. Right. It's a click, I think. You know, once you understand that, you understand why she is being attacked that way.
Well, it is pretty bizarre, though, that there's this strange collusion with Trump and the Russians. Now, the columnist Krugman in the Times thinks that, and he's another number of other people I've talked to are working on finding, there's a lot of smoke, they haven't found the fire yet, about this confluence where the Siloviki, the people around Putin, are under sanctions. So they've got to park their money somewhere. Donald Trump, on the other hand, has been blackballed by all the American banks because he's taken them down and forced bankruptcies. So there's a confluence there where he needs money.
Oh, that's news to me. I had not thought of that. all right.
But isn't it odd to have the Republican candidate for president basically, buddy with a guy.
No, it's not odd. It's authoritarians unite.
Yes. Well, but then it does give a lie to that.
It's testosterone poisoning 101. No, I mean that they're dictators. It's not odd.
I suppose not.
But
it's shameful, though, that the party itself, this is what bothers me more than anything, is that the party that you talked about, of Rockefeller and Percy and all of those endangered species now, the moderate Republicans, whatever vestiges there are of those kind of people, they are not stepping up. They're basically, they're absolutely lacking any kind of moral fiber. All they're saying now is, well, we got to go along with him because otherwise Hillary Clinton will put liberals on the Supreme Court.
Well, not everybody is saying that. And I mean, we each have a place to campaign in which we have experience or a level of trust. We just have to figure out what that is. Mm. And I see Republican and independent women who are very clear that they don't have a party because they've been done out of their Republican Party by policy and the issues for quite a long time. And yet Democrats and also feminists sometimes say to them, how can you be a Republican? You know, I mean, that's not going to help. We just have to say, look, forget about parties. Let's look about the issues and what's good for us and treat each other with respect and get ourselves out to vote. What worries me the most is that we are looking at the top, not at ourselves.
Well, that's always the tendency, though, isn't it, to expect the man on a white horse to solve all of our problems.
Yeah, but we have to cut that out. If we want to have a democracy, we have to have a democracy.
Exactly. Well, you know, right. Obama didn't say, yes, he can. He said, yes, we can. But the we never showed up. And a lot of people were critical of him. Let me talk a little bit about your book. And particularly, here we are, and I keep wanting to talk about the current absurdity, but there's nothing more absurd than the idea that all of these Republicans in the House and the Senate are blocking funding for Zika by putting poison pill riders in bills to protect the Confederate flag, to defund Planned Parenthood, and to defund the Clean Water Act. And yet the mosquito knows no bounds, and it's in all these southern states where these representatives are. And, of course, they all talk about how much they care about the life of the unborn. With a pregnant woman with mosquitoes buzzing around her, you'd think that would somehow resonate.
Of course, that's true. But you have to remember sort of 101. 101 is that hierarchies generally start with controlling reproduction. And, you know, how many children and who owns them and systems of legitimacy. And racism redoubles that because in order to maintain race or caste in India or class in the long run, you have to control reproduction even more, who has children with whom. So that is the first step in any authoritarian hierarchical regime. And that's why it is, you know, rock bottom for them. And it's especially rock bottom right now because in very short order, this country will no longer be a majority European American or white country. Mm-hmm. So those who were born into this and accepted the idea of a racial hierarchy, which is ridiculous, but who really deeply feel that they... there's a reason why it's angry white males who are mainly for Trump as one demographic group. Mm-hmm. So they are against immigration. They're terrified of immigration. They're terrified of Planned Parenthood, of because they just look me in the eye and say the white race is committing suicide. They're very clear about what their motivation is. So, you know, it's not illogical. It is logical. But they are not in the majority on issues. And if we take responsibility for getting out our neighbors and our people, we all have people who trust us.
Well, that's the enthusiasm gap, isn't it? I mean, his people are fired up. They may not have the numbers, but they're all going to show up.
Well, I don't know, but our people are a combination of enthusiastic and terrified, but in any case, we're going to show up.
Whatever. Right. So, but I mean, I wanted to mention that a good friend was reading your book, and I saw her in tears because of that extraordinary opening of this young woman in London going through
the
this
dedication.
Experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, and finding this kindly man who took a risk. And it's so hard to think of how that person is vilified in this context that we're talking about. Because it's such a moving story.
Yes, well, we should explain to people who are listening, I can't assume that everybody's read my book, right? But the dedication is exactly that, you know, to because explaining that I, as a young woman, I actually found his name in the phone book, you know, in London, Dr. John Sharp. And he was taking a considerable risk by being the first person to sign a paper saying, you know, that really, theoretically anyway, my life was at risk. I mean, he was taking, you know, a chance. And he said to enable me to have an abortion. And he said, you must promise me only two things. One, you will never tell anyone my name. And two, you will do what you want to do with your life. Mm-hmm. So after all these years, I must say, I did never tell anyone his name, but then, of course, he's no longer living in, you know, for a very long time. So I just said to him in wherever he is, you know, I've done the best I could with my life. This book is for you.
Well, I wonder, there's so much to talk about in terms of the book. Let's just, we've got a few minutes left here. I wanted to talk about what brought you to understanding and being so influenced by Native American culture and political life. And I know we once had a conversation where you pointed out that the Cherokees, you know, the men may get to vote, but the women choose the candidates.
Well,
not quite that way.
Yeah, it's not quite. I mean, the men may speak at meetings, but the women choose who speaks. I mean, it's about balance, whatever form it takes. And actually, our Constitution is based on the Iroquois Confederacy and levels of consensus seeking. And many of the languages don't have gender, actually. Right. They don't have gendered pronouns, he and she. Some cultures have five genders. I mean, you know, and women definitely knew very well how to decide when and whether to have children with herbs and abortifacients, and men participated in childbirth. And the paradigm of culture seems to have been, in most of the ones I know about, really, I don't pretend to know all, but was a circle, not a pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And that's profoundly different, you know, to understand that we are linked, we are not ranked, is profoundly different.
And this is, has this sort of led you to the Bushmen and other?
Yes, yeah. Yes, because, of course, that's where we all came from in the first place.
Right.
And I did, beginning 20-some years ago, visit the Kwai and the San, and the Bush people in the Kalahari. And the women took me out, you know, to show me with their digging sticks what they use for contraception, abortifacient, headaches, migraine headaches, and very, very sophisticated. And the wonderful thing was they showed me their games, or a game, which is like a relay race in which they kind of twirl around and sing a song and throw a gourd so the other person can catch it, not so they can't.
Right.
What a concept. It's about cooperation.
And what led you to the Jeju Islands? I remember one of the last times we talked, you were off the islands between Japan and Korea. Were you involved in some of that protest?
Jeju Island, which is an especially beautiful island at the
tip
of South Korea.
Isn't it? Yeah.
It's a formerly volcanic island, so there's still enough heat coming up so that, you know, deep under the earth, so that orchids grow wild and walnut forests. I mean, it's just incredibly beautiful. And what are we doing as a result? Building a naval base there to destroy the coral coastline. So I was involved, and I'm still involved, although we haven't been successful at all, in trying to stave off that base, which is a project both of the South Korean government and the U.S. government.
Right. Well, I can only say that everybody should get hold of your book, Gloria, My Life on the Road, which continues, and here you are visiting us on the road, and I won't even ask you. We've already talked about where you've been, so I imagine the
well,
next
I have
few
stops
days.
In Arizona, Texas, and, you know, on the way home to right. New York, yes, right.
Well, I'm glad that we crossed paths. I actually came from New York this morning, so. Just a final exhortation, if you will, because it is alarming to think that this country could at this point, a person that is so manifestly dangerous, unqualified, unstable, uncaring, could be the president of the United mm-hmm. States. It simply cannot come to pass.
No, I agree. And in this book, perhaps the most relevant thing is a sequence of events that's, you know, for want of a nail, the shoe was lost, for want of a shoe, the horse, the battle. All right, this is for want of just a few thousand votes in Missouri. Danforth right. went back to Washington. Danforth took with him Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas was right. therefore visible as a rare black conservative willing to go against his own community. Right. Therefore, he was appointed to the EEOC to try to dismantle it. Therefore, then he gets on the Supreme Court. He becomes the deciding vote that makes Bush president instead of Gore, because Gore did indeed, right. as has been widely demonstrated, right. Win the presidency by winning Florida. Right. Then you get two invasions of Iraq under false, first right. one certainly under false pretenses because of right. the oil. You get the war in Afghanistan. You get a division of human of wealth in this country bigger than ever before, right. beginning with Bush in this period of time. Anyway, it's huge, and a right. very different attitude toward global warming than Gore would have brought to the White House, right. all because of a few thousand votes in Missouri.
And the woman that you campaigned for, what was her name?
We yeah. have to look a minute.
I know
it,
she
right.
and she.
Yeah, and she that she was she was yes she yeah. was running for the Senate.
And
if she had won, right. you know, then none of these things would
right.
have
this
happened.
This is the dark side of the butterfly wing that
yes.
sets off all the.
But it's my it's I really want to, to the extent that you and I sitting here have right. any impact on what's happening, that you and I are butterfly wings. I just want to say that sequence of events with a few thousand votes bringing about everything that. You know, right. all the sequence. That's what we have to remember. We have to stop asking, you know, why don't they do something?
Right.
And say, what can we do? And I don't care how small it is. We have to do it.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in the studio, Gloria Steinem.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Gloria Steinem, a writer, lecturer, and feminist activist who in 1972 co-founded Ms. Magazine. Her latest book is just out in paperback is My Life on the Road. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Mm-hmm.